The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to
discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group,
a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement.
Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The University of New Hampshire has an endowment of about $250 million. Dartmouth, somewhere around $4.5 billion. But none compare to Harvard's. A whopping $36 billion endowment, greater than the GDP of Jamaica, Mongolia, and dozens of other sovereign nations. And these funds are tax-free. Harvard and other generously endowed private schools are nonprofits, so the government does not get a penny of those billions. Now a former Department of Education official is arguing it's time to tax Harvard's stockpile and distribute those dollars to smaller, needier schools. Jordan Weissman is senior business and economics correspondent in Slate, where he covered the issue. Hello, Jordan.
Hi, Virginia. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for being here. So what does Harvard do with its considerable endowment?
Makes a lot of money off of it. No, that's ungenerous. Like any school, Harvard says its endowment exists for a number of reasons. But one of them is that every year it cashes out some of its investment portfolio and uses that to pay its bills. And as the endowment grows over time, they can take out the same percentage each year, you know, 4 or 5%, and have more to spend because the endowment's getting bigger.
Well, they also have a significant investment portfolio. In fact, some have called the Harvard endowment a hedge fund.
Yeah. So the joke the first reference to this joke I've been able to find is from, I think, 2008. But, a lot of people say Harvard is a hedge fund with a school, with an institution of education that just happens to be attached, or a hedge fund with a school attached. when you have a $36 billion investment portfolio that's managed by some in-house experts, then, yeah, it starts to look a little like that.
So let me get this right. A big part of the argument for taxing endowments is that the federal government views taxation as a default. So any tax exemption, whether to a nonprofit or to an individual, is considered a form of spending. Have I got that right?
Yeah, basically. So if you talk to a Washington budget wonk, right, they talk about tax breaks as tax expenditures. Because from the federal budget's perspective, yeah, you're subsidizing somebody by not taxing them, by not taking the money that they would otherwise owe. And so in Harvard's case, they have a big investment advantage over certain other investors. The issue here is that most people don't really think about that tax subsidy when they consider the amount of money that the United States spends on education. They think about things like the amount of money state governments appropriate, or they think about what the federal government gives for Pell Grants or for tax breaks directly to parents. This almost secret subsidy that goes to colleges, it just doesn't really get discussed a lot. And it turns out it could potentially be really big if you look at it on a per-student basis.
So let's look at that. Mark Snyder, he's a former Department of Education official, partnered with a former president from the University of Phoenix, and released a report. Now, this was comparing subsidies to state schools versus private institutions like Harvard and Yale. Now, what did they find?
Yeah, so what they did specifically is they looked at that tax subsidy that private colleges get on their endowments because they don't have to pay anything to the IRS. And they looked at the amount of money that state schools get directly from legislative appropriations. And the contrasts are shocking at points. The most extreme example is that Princeton, on a per-student basis, got about $105,000 in tax benefits in 2013. that's for each and every grad student and undergrad, $105,000 in tax savings on their endowment. If you look at a state flagship like Rutgers, they got $12,300 in appropriations.
Wow.
If you look at Harvard, who we've been discussing, they got about $48,000 per student, whereas University of Massachusetts at Amherst got about $9,900.
Okay, and again, they're not directly getting this money from the government, but they're getting it in the form of tax subsidies. They're not paying out.
The private schools are getting that. And so one thing to keep in mind is that this study that Schneider and his partner, Claude Alva, did, it's in a lot of ways an approximation of how much these colleges are saving on taxes. I say in my piece, there are reasons to think they're probably exaggerating it a bit. Suffice to say, if you look at their findings and you consider other research that's been done about the really gross inequality between colleges, which in a lot of ways looks like American wealth and income inequality writ large, it makes sense. It makes sense to think that a huge share of these tax advantages are going to a relatively small number of private schools. And what then you have to wonder is, in a world where we have limited resources for higher education, is this the best way to spend it? Or could we claw back some of those tax advantages and maybe take that money and spend it on needy community colleges?
Should Harvard's $36.5 billion endowment be taxed and the endowments of other private colleges? Well, Jordan Weissman is with us. He's senior business and economics correspondent at Slate, and he researched that question. We should also point out, Jordan, that you're skeptical of this report because of who published it as well. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so this report came from a group called Nexus Research, and it was founded essentially with money from the University of Phoenix, which is a for-profit, one of the biggest for-profit education companies. Some of their initial research that they produced really was just kind of boosterism for the for-profit industry, which I think anyone who's kind of read a little bit about it is aware is pretty nefarious in a lot of ways. The reason why I do take this paper fairly seriously, though, is because Schneider, the Department of Education official, is a respected guy in the field. He's not a lightweight. He was the commissioner of essentially the Department of Education Statistics Bureau for a while. It's easy to come with criticisms of it, but it dovetails with a lot of things we kind of already know about the way higher education works today and inequality in higher education.
Of course, Harvard's money managers, they certainly don't want to pay taxes on the endowment. Now, how much would that tax be?
So, in their paper, they suggest, a kind of tax on all schools with an endowment over $500 million. And they say that tax could be progressive. It can go from 0.5% to 2% for a school like Harvard. And they think that would raise about $5 billion a year total. And again, what we're talking about here is actually just taxing the total value of the endowment. I think that's one approach you could take with it. Another simpler way might just be to say, okay, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Stanford, you guys have to pay capital gains taxes.
Well, Jordan, don't other nonprofits also have huge endowments, or some of them? So whereas the argument could be made that, the Ivy League schools, their endowments are protected by the American elites and no one dares touch them. Is there a danger of some exceptionalism at play at singling them out because they have so much money?
I think there is a little bit of danger. And in my piece, I talk about this. I give the example of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, which I love deeply. I've been going to it since, I was a little kid and staring at the arms and armor there. But it's got a $3 billion endowment, and it's not paying taxes on its returns on that portfolio. And maybe that's not the best use of government subsidy. Maybe we should start thinking about taxing these very, very wealthy nonprofits in order to use that money for slightly more productive purposes.
I think the Harvard endowment and like endowments get discussed once every couple of years. But now we are at a point where the cost of education is a big issue for a lot of American families and has played out in a big way on the campaign trail. What do you think the chances of a proposal to, and I'm going to say it, redistribute the wealth at the top to more needy schools has of going anywhere?
Right now, not a lot, but ideas sometimes take a while to gestate. Sometimes, ideas come before their time and then their time shows up and you never know when that's going to be. So I think it's worth talking about. And certainly, Harvard's endowment isn't getting any smaller anytime soon unless we have another giant stock market crash or another financial crisis, you know, these portfolios, the wealth of these schools is only going to grow.
Jordan, thank you for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Jordan Weissman, he's senior business and economics correspondent at Slate. And we do have a link to read his article, Is It Time to Tax Harvard's Endowment? That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Endowments are a really big issue for a select few colleges and universities, but on the presidential campaign trail, the hot topic in education is student loan debt.
No student should have to borrow to pay tuition at a public college or university.
And the inefficiencies of our higher education system are passed on with recourse debt effectively for students.
Loans. I owed over $100,000 just 4 years ago.
No surprise, since student loan debt is now the second largest source of consumer debt, totaling more than $1 trillion. And 7 million of those borrowers are currently in default. But as counterintuitive as it may seem, our next guest says that reducing the amount students borrow will not solve the default problem. Susan Donarski is professor of education, public policy, and economics at the University of Michigan. She's also a frequent contributor to the New York Times blog The Upshot, where she recently wrote about why students with the smallest debts have the largest problem. Hi, Susan. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So some very big numbers there. $1 trillion in loans, 7 million in default. Aren't the two linked? The more you borrow, the more likely you are to default?
Surprisingly, the relationship is the opposite. The less people borrow, it appears the less likely they are to default. I don't think there is causality there, so I would not suggest that somebody rush out and borrow $50,000 in order to make sure that they don't default. What's going on is that those who borrow small amounts and those who borrow large amounts are very different borrowers.
So what do you mean by small amounts, large amounts?
About half of those who default borrow less than $10,000.
Wow, okay, that's shocking.
Yes, these are not the numbers that we see in the headlines.
And on the upper end?
On the upper end, 3% of borrowers borrow more than $100,000, and they are the least likely to default.
Well, you said no causality, but what I took away from your article is that if you are spending a lot more on education, you're probably making a lot more money, and you can repay your loans.
I think what's going on is that there's a third factor. When you look at the folks who are in the top there with $100,000 debts, those are disproportionately people who are borrowing for graduate school. So we're talking about people who have already graduated with the BA, so they got through that hurdle. Only half of people who go for a BA actually get one. And they've moved on to graduate school, so it's a select group of people who indeed go on and earn a lot more. If you look at the folks who are in the bottom in terms of borrowing, those tend to be people who just went for a short time, went to a for-profit institution, went to a community college, dropped out after only getting a few credits, and they went in with low earnings, and they're coming out with low earnings.
What percentage, Sue, of that 7 million defaulters do you think these lower, the number of those defaulting on much smaller loans is?
Half of the 7 million defaults are for amounts less than $10,000.
Okay, this is really upending everything that I know about this. And, you know, this has been talked about by a number of the presidential candidates. It's kind of emerged on the trail. Some proposing solutions, some proposing, for example, free tuition, in the words of Bernie Sanders, for example. Are those who are borrowing such small amounts likely to benefit from any of these relief or other proposed programs for education?
It's possible that if some of these proposals resulted in, say, community colleges being free, then some people who currently borrow to cover their tuition no longer would. So that would help there. But a good chunk of these defaults are at for-profit private colleges, and I've not seen anything in the various proposals that would reduce tuition at those places. I think to some degree making public colleges free would reduce demand for the for-profit expensive colleges, but they're always going to be there. They always have. They require their own policy attention. They're a problem that needs to get fixed.
Even those for-profit colleges, if you're borrowing tuition, you still have to live. Are people borrowing these kind of sums of money for living expenses?
Yes, they're borrowing for both tuition as well as for living expenses.
So you are proposing in your blog piece that in your blog post that getting students to borrow less won't solve the problem. What then will?
I guess my point is that there's not a silver bullet that's going to fix all of our problems in higher education. What I see is that the free college movement using the student loan crisis as a motivator, you know, that we have all these loans, we have all these defaults, we must make college free. And my point is simply that making college free isn't going to make this problem go away. It might mitigate it, but we're still going to have to deal with the fact that folks that have very small loans still have problems, and we need to fix the repayment system is what I argue.
Well, Susan, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Susan Donarski, she's professor of education, public policy, and economics at the University of Michigan, and a frequent contributor to the New York Times blog, The Upshot. She's written extensively about student loan debt, and you'll find links to read her articles there at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. And now to a practice embraced by the U.S. military, Google, Congressman Tim Ryan, General Mills corporate office, countless yoga teachers, and a high school in the Bronx. Mindfulness meditation. A significant body of scientific evidence shows that even limited practice improves attention and reduces stress. Brain imaging shows that long-term mindfulness training can help thicken the cortical regions associated with attention and sensory processing. We read in The Atlantic about how mindfulness meditation is being used in schools and about some of the programs now training teachers. Argos Gonzalez is one of them. He's an English teacher at the Schomburg Satellite School in the Bronx. It's a small high school for students who've dropped out or fallen behind. He's also adjunct instructor at Hunter College, where he teaches literary instruction. And Argos, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, tell us a little bit about the Arturo Schomburg Satellite Academy. This is in the Bronx. It's a transfer school. Now, what does that mean?
So transfer school are for students who, for a lot of reasons, sometimes have to leave their old and former school. So sometimes they might look for another option so that they could graduate. So the students that come to us have sometimes been pushed out or have dropped out or have fallen behind and really just want to get their degree. So they come to us for support and help.
Now, mindfulness can be very difficult to explain even to adults. How do you introduce this concept to students?
Well, a lot of it is experiential. I ask them to take a couple of breaths with me, and then I ask them to see if it had an impact on them. And even that small act of taking a couple of breaths and pausing to pay attention to it usually sparks their interest. And then we'll kind of troubleshoot what some issues they might have when they can't really just be present in the moment, meaning, guys, you're supposed to be paying attention right now, but what are you really thinking about? Things like that. And by just bringing attention to things that happen in their life and talking about small experiences that we share together, just those two things creates a lot of buy-in for them, and then they're willing to explore it a little bit more.
What do you think are some of the things that would be on the minds of your students?
So a lot of them are worried about graduation. A lot of them are worried about, you know, their family situations, where they're going to go to work, whether they are going to have a place to stay, some of them, for the night. I mean, it really, really varies at the school that I'm in. Some students have very normal lives. They're just worried about going home to play video games or to go see their boyfriend or their girlfriend. But a lot of the students that I deal with are thinking about a lot of the things that grown-ups are thinking about, how to pay bills, how to take care of themselves and their loved ones, and how to, you know, reach their dream.
And how long and how often do you do these meditation practices in the classroom?
I have 90-minute blocks, but I don't do 90 minutes of mindfulness with them. I'll have them come in and I'll have a do now on the board. And then at some point I'll ring my singing bowl, and then we'll do like maybe a 5-minute, if that long, practice. And then we'll just talk about it and debrief for it. So at the most, we're spending 10 to 15 minutes, 3 to 5 minutes of it practicing, and the rest of the time debriefing.
And are they able to stay with it? I mean, I'm just imagining classrooms when I was in high school, you know, people passing notes or laughing or, you know, now looking at their phones.
Yeah, I mean, part of the way I've been trained is to know that participation looks different for everybody. So, you know, sometimes kids will pull out phones, sometimes kids will be doing work. And at the beginning, I just really let them know that it's okay. As long as they're not disturbing or creating noise or making it difficult for other students to participate, it really is okay for them to just sit back and just take these couple of minutes to really sit and do what they feel will make them feel better. So a lot of times students don't know what to do with themselves for 2 or 3 minutes. So yeah, they'll pull out a phone or they'll pass a note or they'll giggle. But it's such a welcoming environment that I try to establish that it's okay to do that. And then we'll talk about it. They'll still be allowed to participate in the conversation that we have. And if they're comfortable, maybe even explain why they chose not to participate. So sometimes it creates for a situation where some students get self-conscious because some kids might not participate. So then I'll address that. But for the most part, it's okay. I kind of point out that if you can't really just sit still for 2 minutes, that's worth investigating.
How did you come upon this and using it in the classroom?
So I've been working in the Bronx for a number of years, and I've always had this social emotional approach because I realized early on that they needed that type of support. If I wanted them to do well in class or in school or in life thereafter, I really needed to give them some resources to deal with all the changes and feelings that they were going through. So I always kind of had this approach to being candid about my emotions and vulnerable and kind of asking them questions and then getting into the lesson. But then my wife took this training to teach yoga to children right after we had our daughter because we were having a hard time really just being present and being compassionate towards her because we were so busy and we were so tired. And, you know, raising a child can be really draining. And we were struggling because she was really strong-willed and we didn't know how to approach it so that it was we had a productive interaction rather than us just kind of getting upset and her crying. So she really got involved and she showed me a couple of things that they taught her and I decided to try them out with my students.
We're speaking with Argos Gonzalez. He is a mindful school certified instructor and English teacher in the Bronx. He's been working with his students to do mindfulness meditation in the classroom. Well, you mentioned that you're seeing results. I'm thinking about complaints that I've heard from a lot of teachers about all of their schooling is teaching to the test. It's very results oriented. Everything has to be very sort of tangible. Now, mindfulness may not be testable, but how do you see the difference in the students?
Well, for me, the ability to focus is key when we're trying to learn. So just having them focus on their breath and build up that skill set, I think, has a lot of benefits for them and their ability to just, you know, I have 90 minutes with them in a block. That's a long time to ask students to sit down and pay attention to you. You're going to find that students don't have the stamina often to pay attention that long. So by having mindful breaks or just having a mindful practice that you do at the beginning every time, you're kind of inculcating that stamina and that ability to focus. Something else that I think also supports them is the fact that we're working on helping them regulate themselves. And a lot of times students have a lot of emotions, they have a lot of things going on, and that really gets in the way of learning. If you're worried about where you're going to get your next meal, you're not really going to be interested in the novel that I'm trying to teach you.
Is there any indication you get from them that they are putting this kind of practice to work in other parts of their lives outside of school?
Yeah, it's funny you say that because oftentimes what happens is that I'll have a student come up to me and be like, oh, my little brother was getting on my nerves and I just wanted to smack him at the side of the head. But you know what? I decided to take a breath and I kind of just smiled at him. I told him it was okay. And, you know, I didn't hit him. And that felt good to be able to do that. Or if they're at work and let's say they work at retail and they have just a customer that's just really getting on their nerves, they're just able to acknowledge that, you know, this person is getting on my nerves. But if I take a breath, I'll be able to deal with the situation in a way that will be more responsive and healthier to me, but also just kind of get this person moving on in their life too. So I'll get examples like that often from them. But sometimes also their parents will come talk to me and just tell me like, you know, I don't know, my son is now talking about this mindfulness thing. I don't know what it is, but I realized that he's a lot calmer and he's able to like have more conversations with me without losing his cool, whereas before that used to be an issue. So those are usually the main ways that I can pick up on something like that.
Well, the Bronx and New York City in general is known for, you know, being extremely diverse, having a lot of different cultures and languages spoken there. And I'm wondering if there is any resistance from families, especially to practices regarded by some as mystical or having some religious connotations. I mean, especially among Catholics and evangelicals, for example.
It's funny because that hasn't really been the issue as far as resistance goes. It hasn't usually been because they think it's spiritual or religious. Usually the resistance is more around, oh, I heard about this stuff. That stuff doesn't really work. Uh-huh. It's just a fad. They're kind of just like, oh, I don't know. No way. People have told me to take 10 breaths all the time, and it has nothing for me. So what are you showing me that's going to be different? So usually the resistance is around that. But I find that these students that I work with, you know, at first, it's really hard to build trust with them because, you know, they've been in other educational institutions that maybe didn't treat them the way that they wanted to be treated. So they come here and they're just going to take care of business. They're not going to make any friends. And they just have a guard, like a big guard up. So getting them to trust me is sometimes difficult, but even through the mindfulness, which they are skeptical about, they find that they have these conversations that they feel good about and feel comfortable about. So then they're able to say, you know what, I'll give this a shot, even though I don't think it's going to work.
Well, Argos, you're working in one of the poorest boroughs and districts in the country, you know, with people, some of these kids have been to jail or in the foster care system. Extreme economic insecurity in many, many cases. Now, you've been trained as a mindful school certified instructor. This is being used in schools in the UK and some in the US. Do you think it has applications for kids who don't have those kind of stressors, you know, the general population?
Sure. For sure. You know, I'm fortunate to eavesdrop on my wife's conversations because she gets to work with a lot of those populations. And when I'm talking to her about her experience, she tells me that, you know, everybody has struggles. They might be different struggles, but they're all struggling with wanting to feel accepted. They're all struggling with the demands that life throws their way. They're all struggling with making sure that they have a fulfilling life. So those struggles, I think, are universal in a way. And I think mindfulness supports all of that. Now, some people's struggles are harder than others, for sure. Some people's lives are more traumatic and need a bigger intervention. But I feel that everybody could use a mindfulness practice in the sense that we all have sometimes our minds running a mile a minute, or I like to say sometimes we're on the crazy train and we know we're on the crazy train, but we don't know how to get off. We all have these experiences where we're struggling with just regulating our emotions or controlling our impulses or even just focusing at the task at hand. But I think this intervention, as simple as it is, it can be very helpful to a large variety of people.
Well, Argos, thank you so much for speaking with me. And as I say to every teacher, thank you for doing the work you do.
Oh, and thank you for having me and for continuing the conversation.
Argos Gonzalez is a Mindful School certified instructor and English teacher at the Schomburg Satellite School in the Bronx. He's also an adjunct instructor at Hunter College, where he teaches literacy instruction. And you can find a link to the article from The Atlantic where we first read about Argos. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Earlier in the show, we talked about Harvard's enormous endowment and how some types of student debt are worse than others. Creating a fair and equitable system of higher education is largely about access, but not everyone agrees on what that means or how to grant it. Here's another form of access for the disabled, and not everybody agrees on what that requires either, or even how to symbolize it. Roman Mars of the podcast 99% Invisible has the story.
If I'm in Belgrade or Shanghai or Sao Paulo, I can look at a sign and know instantly, without speaking a word of the local language, that this floor is slippery, that the emergency exit is over there, and that that substance is poisonous and I should not eat it.
The group behind those internationally recognized logos is called ISO, the International Organization for Standardization.
That's reporter Lauren Ober.
And one of the most recognizable ISO symbols is the International Symbol of Access. That's the formal name of the blue and white logo with the stick figure in a wheelchair. Around the world, you see the International Symbol of Access everywhere. parking spaces, on buttons that operate automatic doors, anywhere where there's an indication of special accommodations made for people with disabilities.
Prior to the late 1960s, there was no universally agreed upon accessibility icon. Everyone used a different symbol, if they bothered to use one at all.
But in the 1960s, the disability rights movement started picking up steam. In 1968, a group now called Rehabilitation International announced an international symbol of access, the standard wheelchair icon.
I think the current image always has to be lauded for its historic importance. It's a form of wayfinding. It's a form of easy navigation in the environment.
People began to pay attention to the kinds of special building accommodations that spaces need to be inviting for people with varying degrees of ability.
It's politically so important that now you know you're guaranteed when you go out, you're going to find one of these spaces that's reserved. You're able to count on accommodation.
But this isn't the end of the story. Because as the logo got absorbed into the built environment, people with disabilities and their allies started finding it kind of lacking.
The shapes of the body and the body parts on that icon are squared off and geometric.
It has this immobile look to it.
The head dangles from the neck, and the neck is in this kind of unnaturally erect posture. There's not a sense of organic shapes of the body in space.
That's Sarah Hendren, by the way.
My name is Sarah Hendren. I'm an artist and design researcher.
Sarah is the co-founder of the Accessible Icon Project.
They've created a new icon that they hope will ultimately replace the ISO standard. It's still a white figure in a wheelchair positioned in a blue field, but the head and body are tilted forward.
The arm is angled back, as if it's propelling the user, and the wheel looks like it's in motion.
You'll do a pretty good job picturing it if you imagine the new logo as the old logo, but italicized.
So, as much good as the current logo has done, Sarah Hendren, among others, takes issue with how the logo portrays people with disabilities.
And this new logo grants a sense of autonomy to the figure in the wheelchair.
Sarah Hendren says this project is a process of consciousness raising, quote unquote, so that each time the sign is officially changed, there's intention around it and dialogue about disability.
But a symbol meant to start dialogue and spread through grassroots action is very different than one created to be a universal and internationally recognized symbol. There's a lack of clarity as to whether this new sign meets the standards put into effect by the Americans with Disabilities Act.
New York City had planned to adopt the new logo in all five boroughs, but this legal ambiguity caused them to hold off implementing it. At least for now.
I think a lot of people end up buying that old original image because they're nervous about complying with ADA code. And I think what we're trying to do is say, look, as long as it's perfectly clear that you're indicating access for wheelchair users, you can do a different kind of version of the icon.
Having one unified icon can tell one clear story all over the world. But sometimes stories change. The group behind the original symbol of access is called Rehabilitation International. Well, in the 1940s, it was known by another name, the International Society for the Welfare of Cripples. The meanings and associations that words have shift over time, and sometimes the symbols need to as well. 99% Invisible was produced this week by Lauren Ober with Sam Greenspan, Avery Truffleman, and me, Roman Mars. We are a project of KALW and the American Institute of Architects, San Francisco, distributed by PRX. Find out more at 99pi.org.
Since that story was produced, New York became the first state to replace the universal access symbol with the new updated version. It is a pretty dynamic change, and if you haven't seen it, you can check it out and let us know what you think about the design at facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Now that Labor Day is past, we can safely say that the song of the summer for 2015, at least according to the numbers, is Cheerleader by OMI. So what's next? The song for fall? Well, after the annual fervor to find out what the big summer jam is going to be and discovering the hit holiday song, autumn seems positively forgotten. So we wanted to figure out what a fall anthem might sound like and to discuss some seasonal trends in the music industry. So we've assembled a little panel to talk it over. Joining me is Carl Wilson, the music critic for Slate, Maura Johnston, music critic and editor of Maura Magazine, and Alex Gale, senior editor at Billboard, which I understand all you guys have met each other digitally. Is this the first time you've actually all talked?
Yeah.
No.
Very exciting.
Maura and I know each other.
Oh, yeah, Carl and I have met.
Okay, Alex, you're the outlier then. Welcome.
I am. It's because I never leave the office, so I only meet people digitally. It's very sad.
Well, I'm glad to have you all with us. And Alex, before we get into the Song of the Fall, how is it that Billboard anoints the Song of the Summer?
Well, we've been doing it for years now, and we basically go from Memorial Day to Labor Day, and we take, without getting too boring and nerdy, the Hot 100 chart points. So, you know, we look at digital sales, streaming on YouTube and Spotify and elsewhere, and radio. And, you know, each of those things are weighted a certain way. And the song with the most points in that time period is number one. And, yeah, Cheerleader kind of was a dark horse that beat out Wiz Khalifa and Charlie Puth, See You Again. And, yeah, it's a very summery song. It's kind of not that much of a surprise. It was pretty inescapable, so.
So that's all behind us now.
Yes. It's time to listen to sad fall music. So.
Well, if we weren't going to go off the Billboard charts, what other kind of criteria do you think help makes this seasonal song, the song of the summer in this case? Any choices for you, alternate choices for you, Maura?
I was a big fan of Trap Queen by Fetty Wap.
Oh, yeah.
And that was a song that I definitely heard. My criteria for a song of the summer is always, am I hearing it coming out of cars? And I definitely heard Cheerleader coming out of a lot of cars up here in Boston this summer. But Trap Queen was also a very popular choice for people who rolled their windows down and turned their volume up really loud. And then as sort of a late contender, and, you know, it almost is cheating because it uses the name of the season in the title, but I was a big fan of Demi Lovato's Cool for the Summer as well.
Well, Alex, you said that you guys have been doing this for years at Billboard. When did the summer song become a thing?
You know, maybe about 10 or 15 years ago is when we really started trumpeting it more. I think the internet, honestly, is part of it, too. It's the end of the summer. There's not a lot of music coming out, and people are looking for something to write about, honestly. So I think that's one way that it started to get trumpeted, because everyone was kind of talking about their songs of summer. But, hey, here we have an actual official list with hard data that can quote-unquote prove what the song of summer is.
Yeah, well, everyone's on away on vacation. The rest of the staff puts together the song of the summer.
Yep.
Well, summer is this kind of shared experience, though. At least, you know, school is out in Los Angeles and Des Moines and New York. But fall is very specific. I mean, fall doesn't really feel like fall in California, for example. So it's another feeling.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think that there is an abstract idea of fall that we share, but you know, it's funny because I think the song of the summer has become kind of an overhyped category in the past 5 or 6 years, particularly. And this summer was weird because really, I would say that nothing really dominated the way that, you know, look back to the year of Call Me Maybe, that, you know, the way that that kind of dominated. But there's this kind of obligatory notion to it now. And there's kind of a relief, I think, when that sweepstakes is over and everybody goes back to school or work or whatever they're going to. And in some ways, we do kind of retreat back into our more, you know, individual shells and silos and experience things more on the basis of those specific experiences rather than this kind of generalized idea of, you know, beaches and cars with the top down.
So what should then the criteria be for a song of the fall if we were going to ignore the charts?
With school starting, I mean, I teach at Boston College in addition to writing. And so school has sort of been, you know, the driving force in my life for the past 2 weeks. And there's a sense of sort of getting more serious. There's a sense of, you know, buckling down and also getting into the memories of fall's past, of school year's beginning, of new starts, and then the thought about, you know, the sunsets getting earlier. And the sort of idea of night sort of creeping in and taking over. So for me, the songs that I thought about, you know, when I thought of Songs of the Fall, I think of a lot of songs that have sort of slower beats, more kind of like chiming pianos, you know, fuzzed out guitars. And then actually the pop song that I really like for this fall is one that I think from the start, it's actually from a record that many people said was a really good summer album, but I feel like this one song, because it has this kind of nighttime feel, really encapsulates how fall can be a time of transition and life getting a little tougher and a little colder, and that's Making the Most of the Night by Carly Rae Jepsen from her new album, Emotion.
Let's hear a little bit of that. So Carly Rae Jepsen, Making the Most of the Night, Maura Johnson's pick for a song for the fall. And Maura, you talked a little bit about going back to school. I mean, I think there's this deep nostalgia many of us as adults feel about the fall. But what else makes a fall song? I'm thinking moodiness, you know, pumpkin-related lyrics. What makes it?
Well, for me, it's baseball, too. You know, definitely anything that you can sort of glom onto the pennant race works for a fall song for me. But I think there is, there's a sense of moodiness. I mean, that song, even though it does reference kind of the ocean and everything, it is in this context where you think you get the feeling they're driving there, you know, when the beach is empty and they have to sneak on. For me, fall is all about a new start. You know, you get a new book bag, you get a new pair of boots, you kind of buckle down and get serious about learning German or whatever you want to do as a project, even if you're not in school for it.
You're reminding me of those like 60s genre records, music to pack your book bags by, or to learn German by. Yeah. How about you, Carl or Alex? Any picks for you for the song of the fall?
Well, I think I identify a lot with what Maura's talking about, but I think in addition for me in the fall, I think partly just as a person and also to some extent as a music critic, there's a feeling of retreat and regret and the end of summer, the sense of something is closing down. And it does bring up that kind of more nostalgic and ruminative kind of feeling along with that kind of twilight feeling that Maura was talking about. And I think I tend to retreat to kind of more singer-songwritery kind of material in the fall. I think, you know, the Carly Rae record has a lot of nice things that feel that way. There's the new album by Destroyer from Vancouver, Poison Season, which is almost a perfect title for a fall album, and that just came out at the end of August as well. And there's a song that appears on that album in sort of different iterations at the beginning, in the middle, and the end called Times Square, which really calls up that sense of looking around wistfully, and you can almost sort of hear leaves blowing around, and there's this sense of all of the characters in the song sort of looking before them and behind them and wondering where they're headed, and there's something very autumnal about that to me.
Well, let's listen to that. This is Destroyer, Times Square.
Artist and repertoire, hand in hand through the great doorway. Jesus saves. The writing on the wall mentions honey playing a game with the waves. You can follow a rose wherever it grows.
Well, Carl, I have to say, I am so with you on the sort of glass half empty aspect of fall. You know, I see it as this kind of time to become internal and not the beginning of a new season, but sort of the end of something. And what I hear in that song, it's like, I don't know, Ziggy Stardust? I hear a lot of David Bowie in that song.
Yeah, well, there's definitely a quality of that in his vocal style. Although I think there's also kind of a Bruce Springsteen kind of early 80s kind of feeling with the saxophones and the guitar solos and that kind of thing that kind of deliberately unfashionable in a certain way that also seems to me to speak to a more interior sense, which is kind of ironic given the sort of broad sounds of that time.
We're talking about the song of the fall and seasonal trends in the music industry and our listening habits. Joining me, Carl Wilson, who we just heard from, Maura Johnston, and also Billboard senior editor Alex Gale. Alex, you're our numbers guy here. What do you think the song of the fall is going to be?
Honestly, what I do think right now is obviously the favorite to be the song of the fall. It's not the my personal favorite necessarily, but it would be Justin Bieber, What Do You Mean? I mean, it's already number one right now, and it has a little bit of a vibe of like going back to work, which Bieber kind of is. It's a little more serious than some summer songs would be. It just has a little more of a serious vibe. It's already number one, so obviously that would be the heavy favorite to sort of be the popular pick for Song of Fall. My pick would be actually a song by Churches, and it's interesting to me that Maura had a song from Carla Rae Jepsen because they're a little bit of a similar sound. Churches is sort of a alt-pop, synth-pop group, and they have a great song called Never Ending Circles. And they're from Glasgow, and they have sort of a windy, windswept, sad fall sound, but there's a little bit of hope to it and a little bit of drive to it, because maybe this is a very New York and like sort of magazine view, but when I look at fall, I'm also like, okay, it's getting colder, but I might be a little sad that summer's over, but I'm also focused and I'm going to get down to work.
Let's hear that. Churches, Never Ending Circles. You know, I hear that song and I think about, well, it's got a vibe of another era, certainly. But also for me, it's not just what's coming out this fall. It's thinking of fall's past. There is a particular kind of feeling. I wonder if any of you have picks of music that you listen to or turn to over and over again that kind of says fall to you.
In the past, the fall has also meant new seasons of college radio a lot for me, like coming back to the college radio fold and finding all the, you know, a lot of new releases. So I have a strong sort of like pull toward indie pop of various stripes, particularly the more languorous and sad type. And one of the songs that I always think of when I think of the fall is from the Olivia Tremor Control's 1996 album, Dusk at Cuba's Castle. It's called Marking Time. And there's something about the piano, which is this really kind of beautifully off-kilter piano that runs throughout the song, that really just makes me think of, you know, the days getting shorter and the leaves sort of giving way to bare branches.
Let's hear a little bit of that. This is Marking Time, the Olivia Tremor Control.
Did you ever see the light inside my window?
Alex, is there a song that you turn to, you know, your sort of fall song?
Well, I definitely think there's a lot of nostalgia there. And for me, when I'm a kid, one of my favorite music moments was opening up Tribe Called Quest album, The Low End Theory, which came out the fall of 1991, unwrapping the cassette, because that's what I had, and playing the first song on there is called Excursions, and it just like starts with just like an acoustic jazz bass line, no beat, and then Q-Tip just with this really kind of indelible, unforgettable verse. And it's just a classic album, and I think I sat there and, you know, just listened to that whole album all the way through probably like five times, and I still do that today.
Back in the days when I was a teenager, before I had status and before I had a pager, you could find the abstract listening to hip-hop. My pops used to say it reminded him of bebop. I said, well, daddy, don't you know that things go in cycles? Way the Bobby Brown is just amping like Michael. It's all expected.
Alex, does the music industry release albums strategically like a movie studio? You know, do they think, this is a really summery record to increase the chances of winning a Grammy or making a hit?
They do somewhat. For songs, they actually do think somewhat about what can work for different seasons. For Ariana Grande's last album, Republic actually told us in an article that they, I think she had something like four, maybe even five singles, and they really planned them out by each season. Okay, this one's kind of a summery one. This one's good for fall. This one maybe has more of a holiday vibe to it. But the more important consideration is usually just like the fourth quarter's coming up, and we need to hit our bottom line. So if we have an album by Adele, for example, or Kanye or Beyonce, to name some of the big albums that are probably coming up this quarter, they're going to put them out in the fourth quarter when more people are shopping, and then all of a sudden they have a profit for 2015.
Alex Gale, senior editor at Billboard, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And Carl Wilson, he's music critic for Slate. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Moore Johnston, music critic and editor of Mora Magazine, thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much.
What do you think the song of the fall ought to be? Is there something qualitatively different about a good summer jam and an autumn anthem? You can share your thoughts on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, or by calling our listener line at 603-223-2448. That's 223-2448. I'm Virginia Prescott. For me, it's a whole album, and I do say album, that I retreat to over and over again in the fall, Neutral Milk Hotels, In the Airplane Over the Sea.
And one day we will die, and our ashes will fly from the airplane over the sea. But for now,
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan, and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney. The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.